A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. The world continues to turn. The press briefing continues to be attended virtually by people who continue to ask stupid questions. And the row over whether to wear a mask or not continues to rage. It also happens to be the Queen's birthday, but we're not celebrating, and I'll tell you why in a minute. This morning, there is a very definite change in the news agenda, with all newspapers seemingly deciding on different lead stories. The Sun goes with Prince Philip's inspiring message to NHS workers yesterday. The Times refers to Ward that wearing a mask might actually risk a shortage for those health workers who really need them. The Telegraph leads with doubts over Matt Hancock's testing targets. And the Daily Mail prefers to make half of their front page about secret text messages between Harry and Meghan's father ahead of this week's court case. There's plenty going on, but the story is shifting and more experts are convinced that the peak of the virus spread is definitely over. Now the debate moves to the lockdown and what our next challenge will be. I'll be talking to former Conservative MP and former Special Advisor to David Davis, Stuart Jackson. 0344 499 1000 is the number. We'll bring you the latest news from the Chateau Marmont as well, where Meghan and Harry are holed up in their luxury bungalow in California. But of course, we want to hear from you as well. We didn't get enough of you on yesterday, so we are determined to hear more of your voices this morning. Tell us what you're seeing, what you're hearing, and you, of course, are the eyes and ears of the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. 0344 499 1000. Coming up later on, we'll find out what's going on with the oil price. Gemma Godfrey joins us from the Times Money Mentor, and MasterChef John Tarode will be popping along as well. And don't forget to get your children around the radio for our homeschooling session, which today will be bringing us a virtual tour of the Tower of London. 0344 499 1000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, before we get started, we wish to note that it is the Queen's birthday, where she has turned 94 years of age. And as ever, the Queen has got it absolutely spot on. She has judged the mood of the nation and she has told everyone that she does not want them to celebrate her birthday. She does not want a 21-gun salute in St James's Park. She does not want there to be banners flown. She does not want to have the red arrows flying over Buckingham Palace. And she certainly doesn't want anyone out on the streets tonight clapping on her behalf. And you know what? She's absolutely right, because the mood of the nation would suggest that even though we love the Queen, even though we really respect the Queen, and even though we would love to celebrate her birthday, this time around, we're just not going to do it. So on this show, we are not going to be playing the national anthem. You have every right, if you wish to wish her a happy birthday when you call in, and you can say whatever you want. But I just want to tell you this. The Queen is definitely the backbone of this nation. The Queen is absolutely and utterly the correct judge of the mood of this country, and she represents everything that is good about this country. So I'm going to say happy birthday, Your Majesty, and let it end at that. Let's talk to Stuart Jackson, who's here with us. Stuart, very good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I'm not at the Chateau Marmont with...
What a pity.
With the Sussexes, unfortunately.
Well, if only they took a leaf out of the book of Prince Philip yesterday, who made a great speech on behalf of the NHS workers, and the Queen herself, who today has asked everybody not to worry about her birthday, not to bother about it. You know, she just can't seem to do anything but get everything right every single time.
Absolutely. And if we look back a week or so to her fantastic address, it was pitch perfect.
Yes.
It was typical of her. She didn't get political, but she she really empathised with the concerns, the worries, the anxiety of the British people. And it's always for her and Prince Philip and some of the other royals, like Princess Anne, it's about public duty and service rather than self-interested, narcissistic PR gimmicks like some perhaps we could mention
yes,
recently.
Yes, exactly right. And do you share, like I do, this view abroad, which seems to be getting more and more sort of credence, that the peak would appear to have passed as far as the numbers are concerned? They're going down. The medical experts seem to have got that part of it right. We seem to have also got the making sure that everybody stays away from the NHS part right as well. And the conversation now turns to kind of the lockdown and what we do next.
I think it's likely we have reached the peak, but there's a lot of what the Americans call Monday morning quarterbacks, people who are wise after the event, who have professorships in hindsight.
Yes.
We saw that from the Sunday Times with their threadbare hit job on the Prime Minister on Sunday, which, you know, as you quite rightly said on your show, fell apart, fell into dust within a few hours. I mean, I counted at least two actual factual errors in that piece.
Yeah. I've never seen such an excoriating statement, and everybody that I spoke to last night who also saw it over the previous 24 hours couldn't believe that the government could be so damning of one story.
No, because I think it's important for them to kill outright this attempt by people who, for instance, have not accepted that we're leaving the European Union,
yes,
or particularly for other reasons hate Boris Johnson. This narrative that the government is either harsh, incompetent, uncaring, wants lots of people to die, doesn't care. This nonsense. You know, this, and I hate to say it because it's a word that's overused, but I can't think of another word. It is literally unprecedented, the experience we're going through.
Yes.
You know, however many exercises you've gone through on mad cow disease or SARS, this is at a different level. And therefore, you know, politicians and civil servants are only human. We can't predict. We have to look at the evidence as we get it. And, you know, the fact is the Prime Minister followed the evidence closely, and the scientific evidence changed. That doesn't mean he's wrong or the scientists are wrong. They were grappling with something they'd never seen before. But in answer to your question, I think this traffic light system that's been mooted yesterday and Sunday in the media of different aspects, different sectors and businesses in the UK opening incrementally over a period of time is probably the sensible way forward. I know my own view is people are champing at the bit to get kids back in school,
yeah,
because this is a long-term problem, particularly as Robert Halfen, the Education Select Committee Chairman, said yesterday. You know, underprivileged kids, kids whose parents are not perhaps as committed to education as others, you know, those kids need their teachers. They need the structure of a school day, and they need to be back in their lessons.
Yes, they do. And also, I think there is definitely an appetite, shall we say, for other sorts of shops to open up. I mean, I was walking into work this morning from a slightly different car park, and I walked past a deli, an Italian deli in Borough High Street, which is now open for business and is serving breakfast. So I find that quite encouraging.
Yeah, well, I think that what the government has done is been quite liberal in the way it's interpreted regulations for, say, takeout. I think they should allow more businesses like pizza restaurants, like fast food, to do takeout if there were proper checks with their staff and in terms of hygiene and regulations. We should start doing that. That's very, very important. But schools, garden centres, you know, I think it's a terrible shame that millions and millions of plants are going to be just chucked in a skip because garden centres can't sell in their peak period, which is the spring,
yes,
which is now. And I think, actually, in terms of people's mental health and well-being and happiness, to be able to socially distance at a garden centre to buy plants. I mean, I'm going to paint my front door this week,
right?
But I'm wondering, you
what
know,
colour are you doing? What colour are you going for?
Well, like in honour of the Rolling Stones, I'm going to paint it black, Mike.
Excellent.
But
was it red? by any chance?
No, it wasn't. It's a rather faded, sad black, and I'm going to give it a new look. I wanted to paint it blue, obviously, but Mrs. Jackson says it's got to be black.
Okay.
But I'm wondering, you know, where can I get a pot of paint, a new pot of paint, to paint my door? And I think it's things like that. Obviously, it's not, that's not a vital trip, but I think gradually, you know, once you get past 4 or 5 weeks, people are actually going to be ignoring the lockdown, potentially, because they're going to say, look, I'm going to take a chance. I can't see my mortgage, my business, my savings, you know, my job crash permanently. And I think the government, therefore, have got to be ahead of the game in at least giving a way forward for people. Obviously, they can't publish a detailed plan. These idiots like Piers Morgan saying, you know, oh, they've got to have a detailed plan. Of course, the minute they talk about a detailed plan, everyone will be out in the park, in the shops, in the cinema.
Well, this is what I've been saying to people. That's about, for example, down in Sussex, where I haven't been for about a month now, the beaches are technically closed, OK? Now, that doesn't mean that if you live near the beach, you can't go on it. But what it does mean is that if the weather turns nice again at the weekend and they say the beaches are open, all these morons will drive down there and start hanging out on the beach and having picnics and barbecues and all the rest of it. And that's not what we need.
No, I think good common sense, also discretion and light touch policing. You know, we have seen a few instances on social media of heavy-handed policing. I know the guy that was immortalised last week on Twitter, the police officer in the park, has, I understand, has been suspended.
Yeah.
And that was right, because he wasn't professional.
Is this the guy who was saying you're killing people by standing about two inches away from a bloke and shouting in his face?
I think this was a bloke in Greater Manchester.
Who
was saying...
the one who said, I'll just make something up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was swearing and being obnoxious. Mm. That's not the way to treat people.
No.
You know, everyone's under stress, and the police are doing a fantastic job. I speak as the son and brother of police officers. You know, they are doing a very difficult job. Again, they've never had this to deal with before, but they have to do it in a sensitive way, because they have to understand there are a lot of people that are very worried, that don't have family, don't know what to do, relying on media, which is not always accurate, and they need to be a bit sensitive. But I think if there is a way forward for the government, I know, talking to ministers and officials, but they're desperate to get a plan in place. But what they don't want is to get to September and October and have a tsunami, a second wave of this, which basically damages the economy and the health of the country, and even in a worse way than... Because that's actually the experience of the 1918 Spanish flu, that more people died in the second wave than the first wave. And, you know, that could be a very real danger that the government is very mindful of.
Yes, exactly right. And I suppose the point of watching other countries at the moment is going to be crucial as well, because Spain obviously lifted a little bit of their lockdown last week. Too early to tell whether that's been a success, but in 2 weeks' time, perhaps we'll learn something from that.
Yeah, you know, there's a spectrum, isn't there, from very tough lockdown regime as pursued by, say, the French government.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Swedish situation, where they've been very light touch. They've allowed a little bit of mingling, light touch social distancing. And I think within the next few weeks, we'll understand which one has had more impact. There's an interesting article in the Times today, in the Leader, which says that those countries in the Spanish flu pandemic at the beginning of the 20th century that imposed the toughest lockdown procedures, in the end, not only had better health results, but their economies bounced back much more quickly.
Yes. I mean, I think the thing is that because we have come this far, and Dominic Raab said this the other day, it would be foolish to sort of lose all of those gains by opening everything up a bit too early. But I do think there is a balance to be struck, because I've heard from friends of mine who are older, like over 70, but there's an awful lot of people over 70 who are very fit, are very busy, and who also are major contributors to the economy, by the way, in various different ways. Some of them own businesses, some of them just spend quite a lot of money, generally speaking, out in bars and restaurants. But they are not going to sit for the government telling them to stay home for 18 months.
Well, obviously, 70 is the new 60, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
We're living a lot longer. There's a lot of people who have their kids off their hands. They've paid down their mortgage.
Yeah.
They've got a big disposable income. I accept that's not everyone. There's still some pensioner poverty. But you can't lock these people in. I mean, it was people are talking about October 2021. I mean, it's ludicrous that that just can't happen.
Right.
Because the economy needs the spending power of the grey pound. And those people need to get back into the restaurants. They need to get back into the pubs and the garden centres and, on the high street. You know, the high street was already suffering as a result of the internet. You know, this is potentially going to kill it off. And I do think you've got to have those older shoppers who are used to going into shops who are not so comfortable with the internet. Mm. They're going to keep the high street sustainable.
Well,
so
do you know what I think?
The sooner we can get them out, the better.
What I think, Stuart, actually, is that this will be the completely reverse effect of that, because given that you're quite right to say that the high streets were suffering, because of the way that the government, I mean, it's a story in the Times today, I think, where it says that the government is currently going to be supporting something like 1 million workers through the various schemes that they've got, the packages that they've got to help people through this. And at the end of the day, the economic stimulus that comes from this in order to stop the economy from crashing might be actually a very positive thing.
Absolutely. And if you look at history, right back to the Black Death. I mean, neither of us were around. Well, I'm guessing you weren't around then in the mid-14th century, Mike. But even the Black Death, if you look at the plague in London, if you look at the pandemic in 1918, if you look historically at these pandemics, the economy has boomed post these intergenerational crises. Even the war, in the period from the mid-40s to the early 50s, it boomed. Part of that, of course, in that period was very significant amounts of government money. And I do think it's right that, I'm not one of those people who is sort of libertarian free marketeer and say, the private sector's got to do everything. Government does have a role in these, once in a century instances. And I think you're right that there will be some government money around. We're going to have to pay this back. It may be we have to pay a coronavirus tax, 1 or 2 pence in the pound or inheritance tax or something like that, because this money's all being borrowed. We don't want to lumber our children and grandchildren with massive debt. But nevertheless, that money in the short term, say in the next 3 or 4 years, is going to be needed to keep the economy afloat.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Stuart, great to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. Enjoy painting your front door black. Stuart looking for some black paint out there. That's what he's going to be doing.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, we're joined now by Dr. Yusuf El-Gingihi, who is the author of How to Dismantle the NHS in 10 Easy Steps. It sounds like a book which is not full of laughs. Dr. Yusuf, a very good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a tongue-in-cheek title. So, yeah, the book's obviously a bit more serious, although it's written with the title, certainly with my tongue firmly in my cheek. I'm obviously very much in favour of universal public healthcare.
Yes, indeed. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because one of the things that has caused us to look into the NHS and how it's run is that some of the log jams in the system are simply caused by the system itself, because it is a very unwieldy and large organisation. And the way that some countries have perhaps been able to adjust to the COVID-19 virus and the supply and demand of everything from gowns to doctors is a lot easier to navigate.
Yeah, so, I mean, my book, one of the things I've tried to address is really to bust a whole bunch of myths, really. And one of them is that the NHS is just this massive bureaucracy. And it's in actual fact, as much as it, at times can be, something of a bureaucracy. The evidence shows that public healthcare actually tends to be a lot more efficient and certainly a lot more cost efficient than, say, mixed systems, market systems, especially privatised systems. And one of the reasons is that with a public system like the NHS, or at least what it used to be when it was when it started out, is that you have a much more integrated, or you're meant to have a much more integrated, unified system. Whilst when you have more marketised systems, and sadly the NHS has gone down that road over the past 30, 40 years, then you start to get, especially when you look at outsourcing, contracting out, all kinds of other market mechanisms, you get a lot of fragmentation. So that's an interesting issue. But I think the PPE scandal, it's a much bigger thing to do with. It goes, way beyond the NHS, and a lot of this is about government policy and obviously supply chains But I guess we'll probably go into some of that.
Yes, we will. But I think the thing about the NHS is that, you know, it is a big organisation. There's no question about that. It's a very big and unwieldy organisation in parts, and in other parts it works very well. What I object to is that, you know, you either are a supporter of the NHS or you want to sell it, you know, and it's not like that. You know, there are people who genuinely love the NHS. I'm one of them. You know, I've used it many times. I had two of my children born under the NHS auspices. I've had great care handed out to people that I know, friends of mine, you know, fantastic care done to my children whenever they've been sick. And, you know, I'm not in any way anti the NHS, but it's like when you start to be critical of parts of it, which don't work terribly well, you're branded as some kind of mad free marketeer who wants to sell it all off to Donald Trump. And that's simply not the case.
No, absolutely. I mean, I agree with you. Things shouldn't at all be black and white. I think one of the things that's frustrating for those of us like myself who are trying to defend the NHS is that the NHS has become something of a logo with a huge plethora of kind of market private activity going on underneath. And a lot of the problems that, at least, you know, the argument I make in the book, a lot of the problems we've seen in the NHS over you know, particularly this decade, the last decade, but really over a long period of time, have actually been generated by this catastrophic experiment to turn it into a market. So, for example, very unfortunate, I should say, example of this was Midstaffs. You know, the huge scandal at Midstaffs Hospital with, you know, with a large number of deaths.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, beyond those headlines about, you know, how poor NHS care was and so on, was actually a very different story, which was that Midstaffs was trying to become what's known as a foundation trust. So effectively to become a kind of semi-independent business, if you like.
But how did that affect their ability to ignore several warnings about the fact that there was bad practice going on?
Yeah, so one of the things that happened was that they were basically, once you're becoming a foundation trust, which is unfortunately now what the majority of hospital trusts or NHS trusts in the country are, is that you, instead of what historically NHS trusts did, which was to prioritise patient care, they're actually forced to prioritise their bottom line. And if they start to get into debt, then they run into huge problems. And this is a very kind of strange artificial situation when you're talking about what's meant to be a public healthcare system, that suddenly the individual components, such as NHS trusts, are having to worry about debt. And so as a result, what they did was they cut frontline staff in order to try and mitigate against the kind of financial issues. And of course, that then had this disastrous...
Well, if that's the case, though, why didn't that happen everywhere else that went into a trust?
Well, each area will obviously be very, very different.
So it's not the practice itself of going into a trust, it's the fact that they were acting wrongly. So I don't think you can make that presumption at all.
I mean, obviously, I can't comment on the specific... I'm not...
You know, well, no, but you can't say that the system is somehow wrong if it only went wrong in one place and everywhere else it was fine.
Well, no, I mean, that's not true, is it? I mean, we've had...
Well, I don't know of any other massive scandals like Mid-Staffordshire.
Well, we've had a number of scandals, and my point is that... there's been a series of these scandals. Midstaffs was obviously one of the most prominent ones. My point is that I think a lot of the times, and I've seen this personally as someone who's, you know, whose dad is looked after by the NHS, who works in the NHS, who's had my own life saved by the NHS, and as you've said, you know, I've had, you know, my daughter born on the NHS. But you know, we've seen a lot of the time as on both sides, as a doctor, as a patient, as a relative. You know, you see this very clearly, that the staff across the board, if you speak to any kind of, to most doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals, are not able to deliver the care that we would always like to. And that's, a lot of that is generated by, it's manufactured by deliberate policies. So, you know, the obvious...
Well, you're going down this road, though, Dr. Yusuf, of making out that politicians are somehow ruining the NHS, which I don't accept.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, you'd have to read the book, Mike.
Well, I haven't read the book, unfortunately, but I'm not going to have you coming on national radio station and tell me that the Tory party is trying to kill the NHS, because it's simply wrong, and quite frankly, it's quite offensive.
No, it's not offensive. They're all on the record, actually, very clearly, a lot of it.
No, they're not. That's absolute rubbish. That is absolute and utter rubbish. If you're telling me that Boris Johnson, who nearly died as a result of getting COVID-19 and thanked the NHS personally, actually has an agenda to destroy it, I think you're up a gum tree, mate.
That's something that's happened recently, Mike, that he became very ill. That's got nothing to do with it.
If you're going to tell me that the Tory Party wants to destroy the NHS, I think you're talking absolute and utter rubbish.
We can run through the historical record on this. I mean, if you really want to, but I suspect we haven't got the time to do that. But this actually, my book isn't about the Conservative Party.
We have time. If you want to tell me what you think the Tory Party are doing to destroy the NHS, then go ahead.
So we'll start probably with David Cameron. So David Cameron, when obviously was
whose own son was severely disabled.
Yeah, absolutely. And David Cameron, that's the personal side, and that's often very different from the political side.
I don't agree with you.
Well, okay, so David Cameron quoted as saying specifically that he wants to turn the NHS into a fantastic business. That was his quote.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Well, that's completely divorced from the whole concept.
No, I'm not having it. I'm sorry. His own son, Ivan.
I appreciate you're not having it. But
his own son, Ivan, was severely disabled and was treated by the NHS. For you to say that he wanted to destroy it is nonsense.
It's so horribly disingenuous is that his son was looked after by the NHS, and then he introduces a piece of legislation, the Health and Social Care Act, or his government does, under Andrew Lansley as Health Secretary, which, by all accounts, you know, even Conservatives now are in agreement that was a disastrous piece of legislation, which basically ramped up privatisation, outsourcing. We know it actually has at least doubled the number of contracts going to the private
sector. Let me ask you a question. Do you think the NHS is coping currently with COVID-19?
Do I think it's coping?
Yes.
I think it's certainly coped better than we would have anticipated based on 10 years of you know, and longer actually, but 10 years particularly of you know, cuts and other...
So 10 years of cuts and complete and utter destruction of the NHS by the Tory party has resulted in the NHS coping with a worldwide pandemic pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it's coped insofar as obviously there hasn't been...
So what's the problem?
A collapse of the healthcare system, which was what was feared because of what had happened in Italy.
Have you got any criticism in your book about Tony Blair and the PFI situation?
Absolutely. Yeah, well, this is, if you give me a minute to explain, my agenda is not, it's actually cross-party. This is nothing.
Why do you have an agenda? You're a doctor.
Well, because medicine's actually very political, so I can quote you that this is one of
medicine is not political, you're making it political.
No, medicine's absolutely political. When you're talking about population health, when you're talking about the design of healthcare systems, when you're talking about even the practice of medicine, these things are all very, are extremely political, I'm afraid. So the creation of a universal public healthcare system free at the point of need...
What do you say about Tony Blair in your book, Dr. Youssef?
Incredibly political thing.
What do you say about Tony Blair's PFI programme in your
book? PFI, I think, is disastrous, absolutely appalling, scandalous thing, by the admission of the people who are in charge of it.
So would you not say that that's caused far more damage in terms of leaving a debt mounting?
If you've looked at my articles for The Guardian, for The Independent, you'll have seen...
I don't read The Guardian.
Okay, well, The Independent...
Whatever. I don't read that either.
Well, good for you. Maybe you should widen your reading a bit.
I'm appalled, Dr. Youssef, that you are taking this political stance...
I'm trying to tell you a few home truths.
No, you're not telling me home truths. You're telling me lefty propaganda. And I'm going to cut you off because I've had enough of it, quite frankly. Go away. This is Talk Radio.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Gather your children around the radio because it is now time for the homeschooling section of the show. And I'm delighted to say that today we're going to have a virtual tour of the Tower of London with London Blue Badge tourist guide Pepe Martinez. Pepe, a very good afternoon to you. How are you?
Morning, Mike. I'm very well, thank you.
Very nice to meet you. I understand that you've prepared a sort of virtual tour for us. So would you like to give us, say, for example, just a little bit of brief history of the Tower of London first?
Yes, I'd love to. So firstly, welcome to Her Majesty's Palace and Fortress, the Tower of London. Mm. And if this was a regular day, in about 25 minutes, there would actually be a gun salute for the Queen's birthday
On
the wharf in front of the palace.
Mm.
So sadly, that's not happening today.
No, sadly. And I suppose today we don't see any beefeaters hanging around there either, do we?
No, but of course they're going to be inside because what people are often surprised when they learn that 150 people actually live inside the Tower of London.
Yes.
And interestingly, that you mentioned beefeaters. It is said that more people have been into space than have been beefeaters at the Tower of London.
Is that right?
It's quite incredible.
That is incredible. Because, of course, it is a working... a palace, I suppose, or castle. Do you call it a castle or a palace?
It's known as a palace.
Okay.
Essentially, it's a fortress with, you know, a palace as well. I mean, it's been used for many, many different functions in its history.
Yes.
So we made coins here. Sir Isaac Newton was master of the mint at the Tower of London for 30 years. It's been a royal observatory. It's been a royal zoo. The first ever elephant in England was seen at the Tower of London.
Wow.
The first ever lion in England was given to King Henry III in the 1250s. He loved it so much, he adopted the lion. It became the symbol of England. Even the first polar bear in England was seen at the Tower of London.
Huh.
They shackled the bear and let it go swimming in the river.
Amazing. And, of course, Traitor's Gate, which is now covered up, was very notorious, wasn't it?
Well, now, we've got lots of young people listening. When they think of the Tower of London, they think of the darker history of the Tower because, of course, most famously, it was used as a prison, a place of torture, and a place of execution.
Yes.
Now, Mike, do you know, have a guess how many people were executed at the Tower of London?
Ooh, now, that's a good question. I'm going to say about 50.
Oh, it's a pretty good guess. Now, I know you've been to the Tower. I believe you've been to the Tower.
I have. I've been a few times, yeah.
Most people that have never been to the Tower have this, I guess, romantic notion that thousands and thousands of people were executed at the Tower of London.
Mm.
The reality is less than a dozen.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. In fact, more people were shot for spying during the First and Second World War than were actually killed for treason during the time of King Henry VIII.
Does that number include the princes in the Tower?
They weren't officially executed.
Right.
They were murdered. Would you like me to tell the story
Please.
Of the murder of the princes in
yes,
the Tower?
Yes, absolutely.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to go back to the year 1483. King Edward IV has died. His young son, a 12-year-old boy, is acclaimed the new king. Long live the king, King Edward V. Now, as a 12-year-old boy, he is too young to rule by himself, so his uncle, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, the younger brother of the king who's just died, is made regent, a guiding hand, making decisions for the boys.
Mm.
Because the new king has a younger brother, Richard, Duke of York, they're brought to London, taken to the Tower for safekeeping. The uncle is then supposed to go to the Westminster Abbey to prepare it for the coronation, but he has other ideas. Because he persuades Parliament that the boys are illegitimate, and he persuades them that he is the next in line, and he is duly crowned King Richard III.
Wow.
The boys are never seen again. Until 200 years later, some workmen are digging on a staircase at the White Tower, and they discover a wooden box. Thinking they've found buried treasure, they open up the box to be disappointed to find two human skeletons. The king at the time, superstitious, convinced that it's the bones of the princes in the Tower, has them taken to Westminster Abbey, and they're reinterred in a place that today is called Innocents Corner.
Wow. And so have they ever been tested? Because obviously now we probably could tell when
That's
they were
very
from.
Very good question. Now, they were allowed to open it once in 1933 to examine the bones.
Mm.
Definitely children, definitely human. one aged between 12 and 14, the other aged between 8 and 10. But as long as the Queen is alive, and I think at any point in the near or maybe distant future, Westminster Abbey are not going to give permission for the bones to be disturbed again, I think.
Uh-huh. And the legend is that they were drowned, is it not, in a vat of something or other?
Well, there's lots of different stories. I mean, even Shakespeare covers this in his epic play. There are lots of different theories. Who has most to gain? We will never know. The great thing about this story, it is one of the greatest whodunits in history. And don't forget that Agatha Christie is one of the most successful authors in history.
Yeah.
We love a whodunit. We love finding about these kind of crimes in our history.
Yes.
And I think it will be sad if we do find out, because then, of course, you know, the game will be up.
So, of course. The other great legend of the Tower of London, which I love, is the one about the ravens.
So, for those of you that have not been to the Tower, you might have heard of the legendary ravens. So, some people have suggested they are the current prisoners of the Tower.
Mm.
We don't know why the ravens first came to the Tower. There are stories that they were there as long ago as the 1660s. However, most people believe they came in the 19th century because of the moat.
Yes.
The moat was dug too deep. It ended up being just an open sewer full of poo and dead animals, and we think it would have attracted the birds.
Mm.
Did you know that one of the beefeaters is actually called the Raven Master, and his job is to look after the ravens?
Ah, so they feed them.
They feed them. They give them 75 grams of fresh meat every day. They get a boiled egg once a week, and if they're well-behaved, they get an entire hare once a month. A
rabbit, wow.
And they devour everything, the teeth, the skin, the bones, everything.
Amazing. And tell us about what people say would happen if they disappear.
Well, there is a legend that says if the ravens fly off and leave, then the castle and the kingdom will fall. Now, they used to clip the wings because they were pretty superstitious.
Yeah.
Now, they just remove a few feathers. It throws the birds off, slightly off kilter, but they can fly.
Yes.
A couple of years ago, one of the ravens was found in a tree in Greenwich.
Yes, I think I remember that. And there was all kinds of harbingers of doom following it, right?
I know, this is
the end.
They're all winged, you see. So they have this very distinctive, colourful ring on one of their claws.
Yeah.
So they are, I think, famous all over the world.
Sure. And finally, and this is fascinating, by the way, we could do this for hours, Pepe, but finally, what about the crown jewels? Because that's the other great attraction that people like to go and see.
So I would recommend to your visitors, to your listeners, that if they go to the Tower of London, do the crown jewels first. It is the most popular part of the Tower.
Yeah.
The crown jewels used in the coronation of our kings and queens. And a couple of things to think about. Firstly, when visitors see them, they are the real crown jewels used in the coronations at Westminster Abbey. But pretty much everything that visitors see only dates from 1660 and later.
Right.
Because sadly, when we were in the Civil War period, Oliver Cromwell destroyed, melted down and sold off the crown jewels. Now, if people do get a chance to see them, one thing they need to look out for, there is a diamond called the First Star of Africa, which is 530.2 carats.
Wow.
Said to be the largest clear diamond in the world, and it's estimated to be worth £500 million.
Amazing.
Just one diamond.
And it's incredibly well guarded as well, isn't it, inside that chamber?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a vault door that weighs 2 tons. It's about 10 inches thick. And every evening there's a ceremony called the Ceremony of the Keys.
Yes.
Which is actually free. You can apply online for free tickets at 9:53 every night, where they officially close up the tower. So,
right.
People should look online, and they can actually get into the tower for free if they're prepared to kind of book in advance.
Right. It's fascinating. What a wonderful story you've told us, Pepe. Thank you so much. We really enjoyed that. Pepe Martinez, London Blue Badge Tourist Guide. If you're not fascinated by what he's just told you, then you need to go for a long walk around the garden and come back and become fascinated, because that whiz is part of our historical country that we live in. It's marvellous. It's absolutely brilliant. That was, of course, our homeschooling for the day. I hope you enjoyed it. Now, we're going to do something even more remarkable. We're going to talk to John Tyrone, who is, of course, the MasterChef host, celebrity chef as well. John, a very good afternoon to you.
G'day, how are you?
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. Now, you were about to tell us about Korean food, which I only just discovered probably a couple of years ago, which is absolutely delicious.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did an amazing sort of 8-week tour of South Korea a number of years ago, and the show's being re-aired on Food Network from tonight. Oh, from last night, actually, and it goes out for about 10 episodes. But it's sort of one of those extraordinary cuisines that very few people know about.
Yeah.
And I think what's really fascinating about it is we're sort of used to, you know, food which is about flavour and about texture. So, you know, when you have a pack of crisps, you know, when you eat it, the sound is as important as actually how it tastes.
Right.
You know what I mean? That sort of crispy, that's what makes you very excited. In Korea, they've got this third thing, which is sensation. So they have things which are searing, searing hot, and they have things which are freezing, freezing cold.
Right.
And so what you do is you get this sort of taste, texture, and sensation all at the same time. I mean, it's quite an incredible cuisine. And, of course, you know, the years of the Korean War meant there's lots of things there which are very, very frugal but very delicious.
Yes, and they use a lot of lights, really bright colours. I mean, funnily enough, the only reason I got into it was because a listener, bizarrely, a British guy who listened to me when I was on TalkSport, sent me a recipe because he knew that I was into cooking. And he sent me a recipe which was basically a sort of chicken dish, and he used that kind of red chilli paste to put it in. Great. And it's got loads and loads of onions in it, and it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. They've got sort of three jangs, which are their paste, which they use.
Yeah.
And gochujang is the fiery red one, which is used in a lot of dishes.
Right.
But, I mean, the thing is about them, the one most important thing for Koreans is kimchi, which is this pickled cabbage.
Yes.
Which has got spice in it. And it's akin to sauerkraut, which, of course, is used throughout Europe.
Sure.
But very, very good food, and it's eaten with every single meal.
Mm.
And it has to be eaten with every single meal. And you know, it's very good for gut bacteria. And the great thing about Korean food is whenever you go to a restaurant or you go to a place in South Korea and you eat something, they always tell you it's very good for you.
Right.
Nothing's bad for you, which is fantastic.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, people think of Southeast Asian cooking sometimes as being very kind of meaty, but they also do quite a lot of tofu, vegetarian dishes as well.
Absolutely, yes. The thing is, they use rice cakes a lot. There's something called tteokbokki, which they make, which are fantastic just in a chili sauce, and lots of tofu. And actually, meat is quite used in very, very small amounts.
Right.
It may be used in flavourings. Lots of rice, and lots of noodles as well.
Right.
And the other thing which has fascinated me is they eat really, really hot food during hot weather, and they eat really cold food in cold weather.
Right.
Which is sort of almost completely opposite of what we do. But it makes sense because if you eat hot food during hot weather, your body starts to cool itself down.
Yes.
So I think it's one of those. The other thing that's great about Korean food is Korean barbecue. And you know, you talk about meat. But what they do is they have tiny, tiny pieces of meat. And then they have various leaves, which they then wrap the meat in, and they put something on top, which is called samjang, which is another paste which comes in a sort of green tub.
Right.
And you fold the whole thing up. So it's like a sort of a salad thing with a tiny, tiny piece of spiced meat in the middle of it, and it's delicious. And it's called sam, S-A-A-M.
Okay.
And it's a fantastic way to eat barbecue meat. So instead of big hunks of meat, tiny, tiny slivers, little tiny pieces wrapped in these lovely lettuce leaves.
Oh, nice. And what about the pork-filled dumplings? Because I've never quite known how to make those. Are they easy to make?
Yeah, mandu, I suppose. In most cultures around the world, you'll have a dumpling of some type.
Right.
So in Korea, it's a mandu. In Italy, of course, it's a ravioli.
Yes.
In Japan, it's gyoza. So, you know, and in China, there's little sort of dim sum dumplings.
Right.
But actually, it's the same thing. It's a dumpling dough, and then inside, lots of cabbage, a tiny bit of pork, lots of garlic, a little bit of soy, but not very much soy. And that's you make your filling mixture up, and then you just wrap the whole thing up, and you can either fry them or you can steam them.
Oh, excellent.
They're delicious.
Because I'm not just asking for myself, because I've started, bizarrely, because we're in coronavirus territory, I've started a food podcast. I basically cook stuff in my kitchen and talk into my iPhone and send it out, and it's done really well. It got into the charts above Jamie Oliver.
Well, good on you. I mean, I must go and have a look at it.
It's called MG's Kitchen.
What's it called?
MG's Kitchen.
I'll have a look at it. Good on you. I mean, Lisa and I are doing the same every day. We're putting up a recipe on Instagram every single day of basic bits because trying to help everybody out. But I think the more that we learn about things, and what I love, Mike, if you're doing this, is you're talking about stuff which a lot of people don't know about.
Mm.
And a mandu actually looks like a tortellini.
Right.
So you sort of, and you can find the dough mixture online or see how to make them, and then just roll them out into a round, put the bit in the middle of it, fold it over like an envelope so it looks like a half moon, and then wrap it around your finger. And I tell you what, they're great in. They're great in soup.
Okay.
So just make a sort of bowl of soup, you know, like a chicken soup from a chicken stock cube or whatever, and then put your dumpling inside it, and you've got yourself a meal.
Wow, that sounds lovely. Yeah. And as a lot of the ingredients easy to find, because I remember when I had to go and find that red paste that you were referring to earlier, I ended up going to a shop in Chinatown here in London. So, I mean, I don't know how easy a lot of the spices are to get, but, I mean, it's probably getting easier now in the supermarkets, isn't it?
Well, I think it's easy in the supermarkets, but of course now we're all in lockdown, online.
Yeah.
So you can go to a lot of the Korean supermarkets and they will send it to you.
Okay.
Gochujang, which comes in the red tub, is available in my local Sainsbury's. Other stores are available, of course.
Yes.
But I do sometimes buy it online. The green tub, you'll probably need to go online, which is called Samjang. But yes, you can buy all these ingredients now online and they will be delivered in a couple of days or maybe be a week. But, you know, we're here until 7th of May, so may as well put the order in and see what we can do later on.
Brilliant.
But
and if you can't catch it live on the Food Network, is it somewhere else that the people can catch up with it?
Yeah, it's called D-Play.
Okay.
D-Play D-Play is also playing my old one, which was John Turow's Australia, where I went to Australia about 4 or 5 years ago.
Brilliant.
So it's really quite a nice virtual tour of the world. I did Australia, I've done Korea, and you know, there's lots of things out there. And it is a nice time to sit back and watch shows like this.
It is.
And find a destination that you might decide you want to go to later in life. Understand a bit about the food and the culture so that when you get there, it's not quite as frightening.
No. It's definitely my favourite type of television to watch is guys like yourself, knowledgeable about food, going to interesting places and showing what people eat. I love it.
Well, Mike, I've got to tell you something. Have you actually heard of Army Stew from Korea?
I haven't.
Oh, you've got to have a look at it.
Okay.
Army stew is this incredible thing, which is noodles with hot dogs in it, sliced bologna, and then cheese on top with chili inside it.
I'm in.
But it's delicious. It's really cool. Army stew.
Wow. Okay. Brilliant stuff. John, thank you so much. John Turow's Korean food tour. Get it on the Food Network. It's on at 7 p.m. weeknights. I'm definitely checking in with that. Let's talk to Ken in Ascot before we go. Hello, Ken.
Morning, Mike. How are you?
Very well, sir. What can I do for you?
Couple of very, very quick things, and I'll tell you about this new responders app I've had a problem with this morning for the very first call. First of all, you shouldn't bail Branson out. I sent you a tweet. He only owns 20%.
Right.
So get rid of him.
Right.
Second thing is big fans for adults now for the schooling section. I follow Greg Smy-Rumsby and also the chap you had on, I can't remember his name, about the bird watching thing. I found this app called Warbler. You spell Warbler without an E. There's an app. You can go out to where any bird's singing, press the button to record, and it tells you what it is. But anyway, that's the quick thing.
Brilliant, okay.
What happened this morning? I volunteered about 5 weeks ago for this NHS responder.
Right.
And I've just left it on, and I got a call this morning. What happened was I rang the number, and it turned out it was the doctor and not the patient.
Yeah.
Or it says a lady isolating. And she wouldn't give me the number for obvious reasons, GDPR and Data Protection Act, etc.
Right.
And she said she was changing it on the website. So I rang the helpline number. But this just shows you, obviously, you know, in times like this, it's been put through very, very quickly because the lady I spoke to, who turned out to be in Southend at some call centre, she said, I can't trace you, I can't trace the lady, and I can't trace the doctor.
Right.
So I thought, well, what the hell is the helpline for then? What it sounds to me is that there's been no what's called user acceptance testing. If you go and buy a car, the last thing you'd go and do is not give it a test drive before you buy it, which is user acceptance testing. That's looked like what's happened with this app. They haven't tried it out with users, etc.
Right. Well, I suppose they'd say they haven't had time in their defence, but I have heard similar stories as yours, Ken.
So, you know, it's always something to look out for.
Yes.
But, by the way, two other very quick things
to
come out with that. Thought Police is brilliant.
Thank you.
MG's Kitchen, I've actually watched most of them twice now. And the only problem is with you being on YouTube, because I'm taking phone calls and doing Microsoft Teams, I don't actually get to finish your YouTube stream till about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But it's a good job it's there.
Well, thank you.
Good job, Mike. And the plank list on Facebook, I haven't been able to update it because obviously you don't post.
We don't film it anymore. We just do it as a podcast now.
Exactly. That's what I've been listening to. But
yeah.
As soon as you start doing that, I'll fill in the Facebook page and so everybody can see where planks are. But I nominate number one plank this week is planks. You know that lady over from California?
Harry!
Yes.
Harry!
Yes. By the way, it's Prince Charles here, mate. That Meghan woman, absolute bloody disgrace. I've tried to tell Harry, never took a damn bloody piece of notice of me.
Absolutely. Well done, Ken. What a top man.
Talk radio across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.